I think we got enough to start. What we should do is that we do have a hard stop at 5 o'clock because many people have planes to catch. So let us try to focus. Let us go with the first. Let us do all the three groups what they have to present, then come back and have a discussion. I think that's better because everybody answered questions 1, 2, and 3. So with that, I will ask Ada to the group one to talk, then Henry, then Petrina. Where is Petrina?
Well, group one really answered questions 1 and 2 in some detail, and question 3, we'll see. But in relation to question 1, whether Louisa should be on the balance sheet, I think that was, full support for the idea. On the preparer side, some of them said their support comes through resignation to the fact that this is going to happen. And the comments made by some of the users is that they have never seen an issue that's as supported by users as this one, and that practically all the users currently make those adjustments, but they don't have all the information needed to do so. We also strayed a little bit into the discussion on definition of the lease and possible structuring that may arise as a result of this, where people will simply transfer their contracts to be service contracts. But then other were making comments that if this reflects their business or if they have really changed their business to do so, then, so be it. Let them be service contracts. There was also a mention about the small ticket leases, I would label them like that, and whether they should really be capitalized or should they be excluded completely as a non-core concept. So on question 2, I felt there was a consensus. We had a little bit discussion from and to, but overall I think both preparers and users felt that two models are adding too much complexity compared to the benefits that they will give. Then the second question or sub-question was, so if two models are too complex, which model shall we have? And we didn't have consensus there. So some were more in support of the straight line and saying even though they need to determine the interest rate, the discount rate, and do the present value calculation to put it on the balance sheet, still doing the straight line would make things simpler and reduce the cost for them. This is on the preparer side. There was even suggestion that it shouldn't be pure straight line, but that there should be some kind of what was the word you used, Murillo? A payment-based expense, so that it is not, so that it reflects the pattern of payments more closely. But on the other hand, there was another group that felt that this should be really, everything should be a type A lease, because leases are, in their opinion, debt or interest-bearing liabilities, and therefore there should be clearly interest coming out of all of those, and therefore that should be the model settled. But there was an overall feeling in the group that it is better to compromise on one model than have two models. So even if they don't get what they want in this one model, they still felt it was better to have one model comparing to the additional costs to both preparers and users. But then there was additional subject thrown in that which recognizes that for some industries, these differences in the types of leases may be more pronounced, because the users are making a point that they felt overall the sort of straight lining or front loading impact is level, but for some industries may be more important. So there was some discussion whether, whereas there is one model, maybe some should be given an option of applying two approaches, but we didn't quite reach a conclusion on that one. And on disclosures, I didn't really hear so much of a discussion about that disclosures are important, said by users, and disclosures are difficult, said by preparers. So I ask you to...
If you have one model, then that will...
Lightning hit the building.
If you have one model, there'd only be one model for disclosures, so it would also simplify the disclosures. And I think we talked a bit about grouping, if you've got... How do you go about coming up with comments if you have, a lot of different leases, and how do you actually group things together to come up with sensible comments?
And please, other members of the group chip in with, there were a lot of points made, so I'm sure I missed some.
You talked about, certain materiality.
because as I mentioned, that type B may include both property and, insignificant, incidental leases. So type B is a sort of a combination between two. Therefore, certain explicit materiality, preferably insignificant leases may be of balance. That, one more thing that I shared.
If none, I'll ask Henry to summarize group two.
Right, thank you. Okay, so on question one, and I would say that for the users, this was a non-issue in the sense of it was obvious to them that these things should be reported on the balance sheet, and there were significant benefits of doing so. And we talked about some companies, businesses that are doing comparable things, but, where the lease versus buy today is different, and just the difficulties of understanding the risks of those businesses and doing the comparisons, because they have their similar products and similar cost structures and everything. So seeing those significant benefits from the proposals in giving a better information base to be able to make the comparisons between, those similar businesses. From the preparer side, there was more mixed views, I would sort of say. So there was some skepticism and not sure about the concepts here. Why are these things being put on the balance sheet, comparing them with executive contracts, service contracts, even allowing for the fact that I sort of encourage us to put the distinction between lease and services of the grey area off the table. So mixed views there. I think in terms of the cost-benefit analysis, when we talked about this from a preparer perspective, and we thought about the cost analysis that was in the effects analysis, I think the point that was made was that there's a big difference between the sort of point-in-time information and the cost of getting the information at point-in-time to do footnote disclosures versus the cost of doing your underlying accounting real-time continuously, and maybe that was something that wasn't, in that analysis. But on the user side, it was pointed out sort of saying, that actually they accept that this is going to have an increase in the costs, but they will bear the cost and they're happy to bear that cost for the improved information. And observing also that at the moment, you've got lots of users doing it different ways, incurring the costs, and actually it's probably better that it's done by the company. So that was question one. Question two was interesting. I guess we had some strong user support for the dual model, actually seeing it as an improvement over the 2010 ED. And so some were questioning about, some of the preparers were questioning, okay, look, I'm happy putting this stuff on the balance sheet. That gives you your information about the leverage. What is it about the P&L? And the discussion was highlighting the importance about figuring out the interest, and that was very important, the difference between the interest and the amortization, if you like. And that's so important for figuring out, the interest coverage and all of these very important bits of information. And so when I sort of pushed this a little bit, users were sort of saying, actually, on the type B leases, so this is the property type leases, effectively that's expense is essentially being viewed as a financing expense in the analysis there. So that was quite an interesting part of the discussion. I think on the preparer side, certainly one of our preparers, actually, in their particular circumstances, having a dual model doesn't significantly increase the cost because the leases will be largely type A. But general acceptance that probably having a dual model increases the cost. I think one of our preparers really was concerned about the accounting for the type A, so if you like, the current finance lease accounting, and wondered why it couldn't all be more type B. In response to that, users were saying, but then that would effectively over-leverage the position because effectively you'd be sort of viewing, all of the expenses as interest rather than having this amortization component. I think that's probably most of the points about question two. And I'm afraid I managed it very poorly indeed. I was told I should stick to standard settings.
Which is a compliment, Zach.
We really didn't discuss question three, except that there was one suggestion for one piece of disclosure from the user that they wouldn't use, which is the underlying asset by territory, so that's something that could go. So in my group, I couldn't read my own handwriting here, but have I caught the main thrust of the discussion?
So, Petrina, if we can wrap it up in 5 minutes, then we can have a good 35 minutes discussion.
I think I equally field in the management, Henry. So, very quickly, to not repeat maybe what's already been said, but I think first of all, we seem to in our group have a lot more discussion about the measurement on the balance sheet. So I suppose the starting point in terms of whether it should be on the balance sheet, I think almost everybody was agreeing that it should. Both sides were agreeing that it should be on the balance sheet, and particularly, you know, the user's side, you know, talked about that being a much better reflection of reality, really liking the concept of a right of use, that, you know, much the benefit of much greater comparability between those who own assets and lease assets. But then the question really came along about, but what about the measurement? And in fact, listen, all you preparers, the preparers saying variable lease payments have got to be in the measurement. I don't know what other preparers think about that. So quite a big conversation, as I say, one of our preparers very clearly saying, look, going forward, people are just going to rewrite their lease contracts so that all of these fixed payments are going to be written as variable payments, and then they won't be on the balance sheet. And is that, a lot of conversation about the measurement. I think actually before our user side more came back and said, well, you know, understanding the reasons the board got there and maybe the simpler measurement, you know, is actually fine. In particular, I think there's a slight difference in the conversation about whether you would include optional payments, you know, payments in extension periods versus variable lease payments. And I think maybe more in the context of optional payments, they were seen as very much more, well, you know, it is completely optional whether the lessee decides to extend or not. So that seems, you know, feeling more comfortable that piece is not included in measurement. But I think some concern about whether, you know, if somebody suddenly was able to get a lessor to clearly agree that there would be no fixed payments or very low fixed payments, and, you know, all of the payments would be based on sales or would be based on the number of photocopies or whatever, that could potentially mean that the balance sheet measurement is less meaningful. One on the prepare side, I think, did, you know, question, or I think something that you mentioned as well came up with thinking about, you know, viewed leases more as executory contracts, and therefore there was, you know, the question about, you know, about the balance sheet and was this the first instance of the board putting executory contracts on the balance sheet. When it flowed through to the income statement, I think it's fair to say that we had almost a united view on saying that we thought a dual approach would be clearly increasing complexity, and that there would be a preference to go back to one model. Now, again, both on, I had a user and a preparer both saying, yes, my first choice would be to go back to one model, and that would be the 2010 exposure draft, to have amortization, to have interest. The benefit being that, you know, the right of use concept is a good one, and that having that flowing through to the income statement made sense, whereas you create a dual model and you have a straight line expense that sort of undermines the right of use approach again. And from both sides, I think a bit of a concern about recreating, you know, a bright line or classification and complexity that comes with that. There was one of our users who said they preferred the dual model compared to the 2010 ED. And just because particularly thinking about, you know, a retailer, they felt that it was a better reflection of what was going on to have less change in the income statement but they would still then have the type B, the real estate lease expense, be part of operating, not necessarily considered to be financing. We did have some discussion on disclosure, not a great deal. I think as far as we got on disclosure was, again, the usual acknowledgement that we can't just write, you know, a list of 400 items for preparers to prepare, that if there was some way of really trying to get a better objective and principle, so that where leases really matter and really make a difference and really are central to that lessee's operations, clearly there would be lots of disclosure. And clearly where it's not, where there are, you know, 50,000 leases of printers and photocopiers and faxes, that somehow it wouldn't be, you know, onerous and they wouldn't have to do that. But we didn't get to the point of, I think, getting into specifics about how that would happen. I don't know whether I've reflected.
Yeah, I think the only thing I will add as an observer to that session that you also attended, Patrina, is that I don't know whether all preparers were in support of having the leases on the balance sheet. There some said that they had, especially one preparer said, it's not very clear whether it meets the threshold of the executory contract. So that's only modification I have for your notes. But other than that, I think I agree with it. Anybody agrees, disagrees with what Patrina said for the group three? Then let's open up for the general discussion. Let us stick with some kind of order here, and let's stick with question one, then go to question two, and hopefully to question three. So I will be a little bit of a time czar here. So there's 35 minutes, so I will allocate 10 minutes for the first question, 15 for the second, and 10 for the third. Okay? With that, unless you guys don't have anything to talk, then it's fine. We can go home early. Yes, Murilo.
This makes sense to say that in a contract in which you have 100% variable payments based on usage, call that the lease. At the end of the day, you are not taking any risks and not anticipating any benefits from the use of the asset, and probably not controlling anything, and just expecting to receive, as in any kind of service agreement, the benefits that will flow as the services are provided. So it's just something that seems to be conflicting, in my view, to have the possibility of classifying something as a lease and still have it being 100% variable. And that creates space for this kind of discussion. Okay, you are keeping contracts out of your balance sheet just because you are changing it into variable payments. But if he's doing so, he's actually changing the nature of the contract and changing the business model.
So if it is a 100% variable, what is that there, is there on the balance sheet to put it?
Sorry?
If it is 100% variable lease payments,
yeah,
under the exposure draft, which is just out a month ago, what do you put it on the balance sheet?
No, nothing. But okay, why would you have a lease at first place? Why is a lease?
So I think, can I just question and ask, so Marilla, are you more thinking that, and I know we've had this view before, that you're thinking that if the economics is written such that all of the payments, whatever payments flow between both parties, are entirely variable based on use, then it is much more like a,
service,
I don't know, collaborative profit-sharing kind of arrangement that potentially, you know, you're thinking that it shouldn't necessarily meet then the definition of a lease.
Yeah. It's more like a service, not even a collaborative. It's more like a service.
And a very accommodating lessor who's going to lock themselves into that. I mean, why wouldn't you just rent it?
But renegotiate. Marilla, I haven't studied the paragraph, but if it's on your premises and there's a commitment to leave it on your premises, but it's only paid, but the payment mechanism is, say, by use.
Okay.
Would you also say it doesn't fall into a lease?
If it's on my premises, but if it doesn't work the way I command you, if the other party has the power to say that the asset won't operate the way I want to, and if there is a disagreement, and he can go there and take the asset, then even though it's in my premises, I really don't see that as such a big argument for saying that I control the asset. Control is something that will become more evident if you have a disagreement situation. When everybody agrees with everything, and it's hard to see who is actually controlling.
But the way I understood Malcolm, which is very similar to my thought, is that whether the payments dictate the right of use?
There are consequences. They tend to be an indicator that you don't control the asset. Because if I don't control, then I'll tend to prefer not having fixed payments. Because why would I agree with a fixed payment if I cannot determine the amount of output that we would at the end of the day receive? I would just be taking risk for nothing. It doesn't make sense.
Malcolm, one of the issues we were raising was if you are a printing business with a very high credit rate, the lessor might be very willing to enter into a cost per copy type process with you because he's been dealing with you for 5 years. He knows that he's always been collecting from you $50,000 a month. He knows that you're an A-grade credit rating. So turning it into a cost per copy to him is no risk, but it suits you as the lessee 100% because you've structured your fixed cost now into a variable and got it off balance sheet. There's no risk, there's not even a risk sharing here. The guy's in exactly the same risk as he was before because he's taken the credit risk on you anyway when he leased you the equipment in the first place.
Kevin, the scenario you just described can be interpreted as there is a fixed part.
Is that?
The scenario you just described, whether it can be interpreted, judged that there is a fixed portion.
In terms of the contract, there's no fixed portion.
No, the principle will require you to make a judgment.
Yeah, to go in concern, there's definitely a fixed portion. But
no, the principle asks you to make a judgment. Yeah. If there is, you should recognize.
The exposure draft says it's in substance fixed payments disguised as a variable payments. You need to do it. But I don't know whether it passes that test. But that's something which is subject to debate.
Yeah, it's how the fact that you, in history, I can tell it is, but
no, nothing contractually binding.
Nothing contractually binding. In theory, in the lessor has got the same risk as he had before. All you've done is restructure the payments. But
if you look like that, history, my contract with my employer says that I will continue to provide services and I will continue to receive money for that. So do they have an obligation or liability? No. History should not be the main reason for determining whether you have to recognize variable payments.
Yeah. No, I'm on your page.
Yeah. I think
your hurdle to get to an in-substance disguised is you're never going to get there.
Yeah.
I think the difference here is, Kevin, what you're saying is when you think about your example, like PK, when you think about it, you view that those variable payments as being, it's absolutely a lease. You've just decided to change it to keep it off balance sheet. And I think what Murillo's saying is that he views that if the contract has been changed such that all the payments are variable, he views that as economically a completely different contract. And that is an indication that it's actually been changed and it's a service contract. It's not actually a lease.
And it could very well be.
Yeah.
I don't want to go into it, but what if it's 80-20? 80 fixed, 20 variable. Will that then does the 20 become service? And 80 becomes a lease? How does that work? Anyway, we can go on with that, but I think that's a fair point to raise, but I think the gradation makes the answer difficult. Robert?
I just want to, you're trying to finish off. These things actually do exist for earth-moving equipment, and the reality of them is they're not a lease, but you're paying 3 times the price for that hourly photocopy. So what happens is, yes, it's not a lease, but you would never, ever use this thing in place of a lease because it literally costs you three to four times the price. So you get rid of it as quickly as you possibly can.
You want to say something more? Any other comments, any other questions on question one? What about your few minutes, according to my clock timing? What about the option period? Any thoughts on that? What about the 12-month period? I heard some one group talking about the 12 months or something close to that. They're okay with certain leases to be, small leases not to be there. Any thoughts on the 12 months? Should that be expanded? Should that be stay the same? And what about the option period? Robert, you?
They're already gaming. My answer to that is, and I said in the meeting, there's a structure in place that engineers a 12-month lease. It's a lease. It's a capital lease. It's engineered at a premium to the lessee. It exists. It's been engineered, and it's gaming. And I think that we heard the comment earlier that there will be an arms race. No matter what you put in as a standard, some people are going to figure out at the fringes how to get around it. And as a standard setter, your rebuttal is going to be you can't write all the standards for all the gaming. And I think we just have to accept it.
Nah. I think if I think it should not result in an arms race. I do agree that probably there will be gaming. I mean, obviously there will be preparers that feel that they need to come across less leveraged than they in fact are, and instead of creating a true and faithful picture. And I think that's a fact of life, and you see that in every standard there will be some sort of can we still do this or not? And I think that's not how you build standard. I think this standard already takes out the huge big game, and we end up with smaller games which are manageable.
Well, one of the games you constructed as a type B to begin with, but on the renewal it should have been a type A. So you're going to get that gaming is just there because of the type A, type B complexity, which doesn't exist at the moment.
I think that's the last 8% or the last 5%, but we have the 95%. So I'm talking about the 95%.
Okay, good. That's Katrina. I hope you got some feedback on that. We are in the comment period, so every comment is more valuable than other times. The second aspect of this today's discussion is a little bit more contentious than perhaps the question one, is the two types of amortization / depreciation, whatever you want to call it, for type A and type B. And if I understand the summary from the three groups, the vast majority thinks that perhaps the two is more complex than having one. I know there are some people who believe otherwise. So I think we should open it up for a discussion to see. My only thing is that if you don't like the two method, to help us to be constructive, what method do you suggest we should go to and why? I think you should frame your answer that way, that it will be very helpful. Otherwise, it'll be like my dissent. It doesn't have any meaning. So we'll start with Martin.
Yeah, I'd like to express support for the current ED. I think it strikes a balance between something that users at the moment do, and that's what do users do. They take those lease disclosures, and they estimate the life, what kind of asset would it be, and now we're now in the process of creating a standard, and the ISB could have asked on the preparers to come up with all the lease details, and also please provide us with the remaining life of every asset you lease. And I think we have to be sensitive that that's costly and something that may be very difficult for a preparer to come up with. So this approach, basically the two type of approach, leaves in place comparability in the P&L between those companies that do lease and those companies that do not lease. and it gets us, for as analysts, sufficiently along the way to get the split between interest and depreciation right. It will not be completely accurate, but that will be too costly and too cumbersome for the preparers together. We are sensitive to that because we, in the end, pay that cost. And the two-type approach allows investors to get a more or less accurate picture of what is now indeed the split between interest and depreciation. And that's exactly where we are, and I think it's a really, really well thought DD, and probably not, it's already, of course, cumbersome to get them on the balance sheet in the first place. That's a major cost, but maybe the additional cost of making it a one-type or a two-type lease, I don't think that's the real cost. But first, the cost, the major costs are in the first thing. And complexity in analyzing, that's it. It's not more complex to analyze between two types or one type. That's not additional cost. It actually reduces even more risk than we already into.
Can I just clarify, Martin? But for you, I think, would you treat, for the property leases, you would treat all of the cost as financing?
Yes, I would. Yes. And that would mean for preparers that the EBITDA would be a lot higher.
Yeah. Yeah.
So my experience is that in many cases, if you look at leverage corrected for leases, the leverage in some cases is lower than it is. It depends on the life of the leases and the amount of rent they pay for it. I mean, that's it's you cannot say in advance how it works out.
I'll go with Peter, then to Malcolm, then to Jane.
I can live with a dual approach, but I prefer one single method. I prefer the A method, and the reason is the following. When I look at the company, and it relates very much to property leasing, they have this contract for a number of years. We calculate the present value of it. We can isolate the interest expense in it. And to me, it fits better into my view of analyzing a company if I treat that liability as an interest-bearing or, if you like, a financial liability. The corresponding asset to me, since it is long-term, is a fixed asset. What the B method creates is a mix of liabilities and assets that I cannot really compare to, for instance, the cash flow statement, which is, to me, troublesome. Because if you have the B method, you need to consider the liability, a non-interest bearing method, liability. And then it becomes strange. You have, according to my view, a fixed asset, but since you don't, when you go to the cash flow statement, you match them together. So basically you have a kind of a working capital asset, which it's not. So I think the B method creates a lot of errors in the balance sheet that doesn't really fit into my way of thinking. Also, I like to point out that in the cash flow statement, I would like to have the investments in the fixed asset separated from the financing, from the liability, not the way we have it today with capital leases where we net it together. I want them grossed.
Malcolm?
So I think as a preparer, I think I would plead for an accounting policy choice. I would say by default, the income statement recognition is straight line. But you could give people the accounting policy choice where the leases were significant. You could, you know, most likely could expect that they would use the more sophisticated approach. If they use the straight line method, then perhaps you can think about some additional disclosures that would enable then users to do some pro forma calculations to, you know, perhaps highlight the impact of using the straight line method against the more sophisticated method. But I am concerned. I mean, I know I have to say your analysis, your effect statement is a great document. You try to diffuse all of the arguments that we might put forward, but I personally believe that for many preparers that it's not trivial to do the split, to do the more sophisticated calculations. Bottom line,
Can I ask you a question, Malcolm? Suppose I bought a fixed asset with financing. Should I do straight line there also?
I would say yes, because to be honest, if your accounting policy choice, if you decide that your financing lease is also relatively insignificant to the operations, then you should follow the simplified model too.
Not finance lease, finance purchases.
There you should follow the simple model. So you just have one model, which would be straight line, if it's, but you have the accounting policy choice to be more sophisticated.
Can I just ask a question, Mark? Because I think you're proposing the straight line for everything because you're thinking it'll take out a lot of complexity and potentially a lot of cost. Would you still have the same measurement basis on the balance sheet that we're proposing, that the liability would be measured like other financial liabilities, and therefore, even though you're doing straight line in the income statement, we'd still be requiring you to have an amortized...
I have to think through the accounting. I don't know if that would work. I think you'd have to straight line bringing down the debt too, I think.
Okay, no, because that's the reason I would...
I think you'd have to do that too.
I mean, we could use OCI bridging. No. I'm not suggesting adding OCI. The only reason I was asking that, obviously, as I was just wondering about... If we were continuing to keep a similar sort of, measurement in terms of the balance sheet and how the liability was measured, I was just wondering how you view just producing a straight line for everything as being less costly.
But the exposure draft does the liability under the financing method, or the interest rate method, and the asset is where the plug is to make it work. Mm. So to get the straight line get done, it's the asset side that gets plugged. So the asset will be depreciated in a different way.
I don't know if I've fully digested what you've written, actually. But, but anyway, I'm basically going for straight line by default.
He starts with that, yeah.
Huh?
Yeah.
And only if the model is, if the company has volumes or it would be a material impact, you go to something more sensible.
Jane, we are counting on you.
Well, I was really... pleased to hear Ada saying more or less what I said in our group, which is that the two models adds too much complexity. So we don't get away from one of the big advantages of the reform, which is to get away from the bright line. And the other thing is I'm a fan of the right of use concept, which means and that same approach, which means that you don't look through to the underlying asset. So I suppose that I would have said that I think we'd have probably rather compromised on P&L presentation, if that's what everybody's hung up on, than to have compromised by bringing in a second model. We talked about that to some extent, because of course we'd also do like the amortization and the financing to be split out. One thing is, if you go back to the original ED, of course, if people do lots of leasing, the front-end loading sort of evens out over time. The other thing to remember is that the biggest part of it is always still in a straight line, isn't it? Because the biggest part is amortising the asset. So, there's a lot of argument going on over front-end loading of a smaller part of the expense. So, it's a shame. But we thought that perhaps there might be other ways, the straight line is, the big sticking point, were there ways of rolling up the expense and splitting it out through a disclosure and just sort of having some sort of cosmetic straight line, but which made up of the two components, which could solve it. So it was interesting to hear quite a few preparers saying that they think that the two going to two models is too complicated as well.
Bob? Don't know if I understand what's so complex. You're trying to reflect economic reality. I think there's an argument that some companies do rent things. Some of us actually pay cash for stuff. We actually have cash and we pay cash for stuff. So when we rent something, we haven't financed it, so why are we making it into a financing transaction that we purchase something and, oh, by the way, went and borrowed money for it? Time value of money is not in all of our accounting measures.
hey, you got a lot of pushback on the income statement impact. You came to what I think is the best you can do and is a good answer of, in substance, trying to show what you're actually renting versus in substance renting versus in substance buying. And it's just not all property leases will fall into that bucket. There are A and B criteria under each of those that people seem to ignore at times, but you can't ignore them. I don't think it's all that complex. I think you've actually done a good job in trying to reflect economic reality and that some of us do enter into rental transactions with cash.
Okay. Sandra?
I agree with Malcolm's view that as a concession, having them on the balance sheet, that's the base assumption, and then you look at the income statement and having a straight line approach on the income statement would make a lot of sense, especially in certain industries. For example, the oil and gas industry, where you enter into a contract as the operator, but you may use it on a 50-50 joint operation. And as the operator, you've got the front-end loading of your costs, but your 50-50 partner has straight-line costs because you're charging through based on your cash flows. So you end up with different measures of your development of the property or your production costs of the property, and there's no substantive difference in the underlying cost. So I think you end up with some problems by having the upfront loading of the costs, and straight line would address many of those.
Right, so you want straight line for all the leases, and an accounting is it an accounting policy choice, or is it a straight line for everyone?
I think it's a straight line for everyone.
Okay.
And are you, just to clarify, are you comfortable, because just back to Malcolm's, because I think Malcolm's arguments were more cost complexity, and I think therefore to get the reduction in cost and complexity, he would also suggest maybe a slightly amended balance sheet measurement, because to me as well, that's the only way you would reduce cost and complexity, because if you just go to straight line and keep what our proposals are in the balance sheet measurement, I don't see where there's a cost reduction. So are you happy enough with the balance sheet measurement? Because your argument seemed to be more, I think, straight line for our industry is a better reflection of what's going on. So are you okay with the balance sheet measurement and it's not a cost complexity issue for you?
There's always complexity when you're measuring the income statement differently than you're measuring your underlying assets and liabilities. So I agreed with Malcolm that perhaps one approach would be to amortize them both at the same rate.
Henry, do you want to come to what Sandra just said? Or
no, it's more going back to the difference in views.
If you don't mind, hang on. Then Robert?
I'd like to address why we're seeing such a diversity of opinions and users. Sorry, my snide comment, it's not surprising this has taken 30 or plus years to get to. What is happening is that we're talking about compromise, and so users are saying, typically users want one model, so as soon as we go to two, we're not happy, and then when you say two different models, it's which one? And so what's happening is where individual users are getting to a tipping point. This is a compromise. And so what we're doing as a group is once you've decided to compromise, how you do the compromise and which compromise is acceptable really becomes on a very soft judgment call. I think that's really a reflection of we've probably gotten this as far as we can go without with this context we've got. It is fair to say that a standard that keeps everybody a little bit unhappy, preparers, users, and auditors is probably a good standard. A standard that gets all of the users a little unhappy. So none of us are really happy with the model you're proposing, but what's interesting is we're all saying, well, we prefer this one. But we're actually, what you're not hearing from the users is that you're dead wrong. What you're hearing from the users is, it's not perfect, but if this gets us most of what we need, we'll live with it. And that's why it's, when we start compromising, none of us are getting what we want, so we're saying, okay. And that's why Martin says two, one, I prefer the old one. I've heard very serious users say, you know, give us what we want, but we'll let them amortize straight line. I know that's stupid from a conceptual point of view, but if it gets the preparers happy and gives us everything else we want, including the right disclosure, if that's the giveaway, that's fine. But I think that's the reason why there's so much diversity. It's just we're there.
In the interest of time, I'm just going to have Sue, then Peter. And Sue, then I think Henry needs to say something, then you can wrap it up.
Yeah, I just wanted to maybe consolidate one point on the compromise, which I absolutely agree with you. I would go for A and stick with it and have the distorted amortization. But I think straight line would work.
Where's the compromise?
There is a compromise here.
Where's the compromise? It's only whipsaw.
One model is better than the two. I think the straight line amortization would be helpful if it makes it work. And I think to consolidate that and sort of maybe make it a little more logical, I think you'd get straight line if you had a portfolio effect, which I'd expect for lots of companies you would. So if we embed the portfolio effect in straight lining, it actually gets us more or less the same place, making it easier for preparers.
Can I just clarify that, Sue, when you say you have to come on straight line, do you mean, though, you're happy that you would have a straight line interest as well as amortization, but you still want amortization and interest separate?
Separate, yeah, I would
separate.
Yeah,
so you're not proposing a type B accounting like we've proposed for everything, because you don't want it as one amount. You're happy to go to straight line, but you want amortization and interest?
Splits, yeah.
Split?
So you plug the asset or you plug the liability now?
You could plug either.
Because it does, you're plugging. You're plugging.
I'm portfolio based.
Yeah. But just to clarify, I think that Malcolm and Sandra are both proposing the type B accounting, one amount straight line.
And that's why I say accounting policy choice. If it's material to the business, then you go for more sophistication, and I think we could swallow that.
Okay.
But if it's not,
Henry, you want to say something?
Well, I need just to follow up a little bit on what was just saying, but I just wanted to understand, is it really the user view that it's a compromise? It clearly isn't some, but I hear Martin speak, and I hear, and this is what I wanted to understand really, is sort of saying, you must be doing something slightly different in your analysis that some other people are doing. And is it because you're trying to more compare the lease versus buy? Because what you see this approach gives you is a more accurate split between the true interest of that business and the amortization. So that's why, you know, if it's leasing land, you're sort of thinking, well, there is actually there's no depreciation of that. It's all interest. Versus, Jane, what you were saying you like the right of use model. So therefore,
I'm
is
not
it
bothered about the fact that the underlying thing doesn't change in value.
Well, I was to say, is it because you sort of see that the right is being consumed, therefore there is interest and amortization in that example? Yeah. Just trying to understand that difference of opinion.
I should just to be fair, I mean, the great champion of the sort of the thing that, as well as Martin, is Jed Wrigley, and he's not here.
Yeah.
And that's very much saying, well, you know, he's there saying, well, let's look through to, are you consuming the underlying asset or not?
Yeah.
So what we ask is in the sense of, I think right of use covers the asset and it's being accounted for separately from what's happening to the underlying thing. And Jed isn't, his, you know, we actually, I don't think we answered this actually, I think we're surprisingly united. It's partly because Jed isn't here to.
Good.
There's one comment I just want to make about talking about one model, though, just to get the views, because if the boards were, then it depends what we hear, to go back to one model. If that one model is like the type A and it's amortization and interest, then I think it truly is one model in a sense for leases. And the reason I say that is that because when you get to leases that are even finance leases today and look almost like purchases, there's no difference in the accounting. If we're proposing what we call one model, and it's all our type B accounting, which is a straight line one amount number, are we actually saying then one model, and we're going to make all leases, including what are finance leases today, a straight line number, and therefore we put real tension on what's a lease versus what's a purchase? The only question I'm raising is, we talk about one model and straight line, but because that, if that's straight line and it's one amount, because that's completely different accounting from if you purchased and financed the purchase, I still think there's a potential that it's not necessarily one model, because if we want to keep finance leases accounted for as they are today, we still need to have that line then. Or otherwise, we maybe need to have a clearer distinction between leases and purchases. just a thought.
Good point. In the interest of time, we have 4 minutes left, so unfortunately disclosures always get the last thing, which should not be the case, but it is always the case. But nevertheless, any thoughts on it? Bob is ready to speak on it.
Let me just ask the revenue recognition team. It seemed like that worked well, where you got the workshops and users as preparers and actually went into the detail and how you're using it. Seems like it was a perfect model to maybe use this one for. I think that's to Henry.
We found it a very, you know, we have the classic polarized views on the disclosures with the last revenue deal, so we brought the two sides together to have some intensive workshops to try and find, you know, a steer about how we could simplify the disclosures without losing what the users perceive to be the most useful information content. And it's something we should certainly think about.
The short answer will, the users are going to want a lot more, the preparers are going to want a lot less, and we have to come to some sort of reasonable compromise. So it's going to be high information, low cost are the ones we're going to settle on, and we'll have to fight it out.
Just in the spirit of compromise.
We'll wait to see what you say.
We compromise as long as we agree with you.
Well, we had a bit of a complicated conversation about all options and you'll want lots of disclosures about that, won't you? Because initially, you know, it was supposed to be part of the valuation of the lease. And that, the fact is, no, we won't. If we didn't want to do an impossible calculation of an option in 10 years' time, why would we want to have an impossible list of disclosures about what's going to happen in 10 years' time? So, no, this very much, I'm sure this can be negotiated, and we don't want it to be death by disclosure on something that's a minor part of the contract, the value.
Any other thoughts? I think Bob's suggestions, we will consider it and see how we can factor that within the time frame and get back to you all. Stay tuned on that issue. And anything else? Otherwise, we will come to an end to this wonderful session for the day. Thank you. Now the public session is over.